This lecture is brought to you by Knox Theological Seminary on iTunes U. Knox is a seminary in the tradition of the Reformation that exists to educate men and women to declare and demonstrate the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our prayer is that this teaching will be beneficial in your Christian life and ministry.
The critical appraisal of the Gattung, I'll work with that. I think that's very helpful. The Sitzungsleben, the reason that one of the Gattung is to get the Sitzungsleben, I don't find that convincing. And there is no real consensus about it. And as I say, in the academic community, everything depends upon consensus. And they want consensus. When they can't get consensus, there's a problem. So far as the Gattung is concerned, I said, actually, the chronicler had told us there are three dominant types. There was the Leheskia, which the NIV elsewhere translates to petition. And then there was the Todah, the confession of praise. And then there was the Hallel, the praise generally and broadly. So the text itself is telling us there are these three types, dominant types. And I think that confirmed empirically. They do have distinct motifs, and we'll see that. They do have distinct vocabulary. They do have distinct moods. They do fall together empirically. And they are similar to forms in the ancient Near East, which also has these three types. However, I thought that Gunkel is wrong in his distinction between the individual and community because he didn't understand they were all royal. And when you understand they're royal to a large extent, then you understand the interplay between the community and the individual, was my argument. So royal psalms to me, because they mention a king, that's not a form, that's just one word. And that's not sufficient for me for a form. The minor types are songs of Zion. So when they said, sing us one of the songs of Zion, well, it might have been one of the ascent psalms, going up to how beautiful is Zion, and they're on a pilgrimage. I lift up my eyes to the hills, and whence comes my help? As he's making pilgrimage, if the songs of ascent refer to pilgrimage. You have wisdom psalms. A very clear illustration of a wisdom psalm, you may want to take a look at it, is Psalm 49. This is a wisdom psalm. It's by the sons of Korach. It starts with four verses of introduction. And very clearly it says, hear this, all you peoples, listen, all who live in the world. Now, wisdom is characterized by being universal and not particularized to Israel. So this is to all people. So both low and high, rich and poor alike. In other words, the message, the low will be encouraged. The high will be humbled. The rich will be sobered. And the poor consoled. Now what's interesting here for reader response, what's interesting here is the same message will have different responses. It's not that the message has changed, but it's because your social situation or your psyche is different, you hear that message differently. So that's why it's very difficult to say you're going to get the same result for everybody when you're given a message. Truth will impact people differently. So it's for everybody from different social comments. Now note, my mouth will speak words of wisdom. The meditation of my heart will give you understanding. Now that's clearly wisdom language. I'm going to give you wisdom. I'm going to give you understanding. You can almost hear the book of Proverbs. I will turn my ear to a proverb. With the harp, I will expound my riddle. What could be clearer that this is wisdom? He says it's a proverb. He says it's a riddle. It sounds just like the preamble to Proverbs chapter 1, so that you can understand the proverbs and sayings of the proverbs and their interpretation, the sayings of the wise and their riddles. Which means its meaning is not transparent. You have to think about it. Now here comes the riddle, the proverb. And here you're going to enter into poetics a bit. Now notice, if you go 8 lines, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, notice if you have an NIV, the NIV is extremely helpful. Notice how it's separated out. Human beings, despite their wealth, do not endure. They are like the beasts that perish. The word like is the Hebrew word proverb. Proverb means a comparison. It's a play on words here. So the point is, human beings, despite their wealth, do not endure. They are like the beasts that perish. Now, you go another 8 lines, 13 down, and notice you get the same refrain, but with a slight difference. Verse 20, human beings who have wealth but lack understanding are like the beasts that perish. Now, that's the proverb. And what happens in the first refrain, first stanza, he's saying, everybody dies. We're all like animals. We're none of us endure. And he says that. See, it begins with verse 5. Why should I fear when evil days come, when the wicked deceivers surround me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches. That's what we mean by a rich person in the Old Testament. A rich person in the Old Testament is not a person who has a lot of money. A rich person is a person who trusts in his money. He finds his security and his significance in his money. That's the rich man, and the rich man cannot enter the kingdom of God. The blessing of God is wealth, but the wise use wealth to enrich others, not for self-aggrandizement. So the rich man has his security and his significance in his money and not in God. And that's why if you have too much money, it's hard to have a lot of money and not make it your security and your significance. And people, if you have a lot of money, people will call you successful because they don't have spiritual insight. Well, no one can redeem the life of another person or give to God a sufficient ransom to save them from death. The ransom for life is costly. No payment is ever enough so that someone should live on forever and not see decay. Now notice, for all can see that the wise die. The foolish and senseless also perish, leaving their wealth to others. Their tombs will remain, their houses forever, their dwellings for endless generations, though they had named lands after themselves. And so they're seeking for some kind of immortality by naming things after themselves, buildings after themselves, lands after themselves, streets after themselves. You might as well write your name on water. It doesn't endure. And so he's saying everybody is going to be like animals. Human beings, despite their wealth, do not endure. They are like the beasts that perish. Now, note the parallel. This is the fate of those who trust themselves and those who follow them. They are like sheep destined to die. Death will be their shepherd. But note, but the upright will prevail over them in the morning. This is not the final word for the righteous. They will die a clinical death, but it's not the final word for them. They will rule over them in the new day. Their forms will decay in the grave, far from the princely measures. But notice, but God will redeem me from the realm of the dead. So no man can redeem another man from death, but God will redeem me from death itself. Now, how can you read that and not believe in resurrection in the Old Testament? I don't see how you can, how even evangelicals are teaching their students there's no resurrection in the Old Testament. I don't see how you can read this material and draw such a conclusion. No man can redeem another man from death, but God will redeem me from death. And that's the third line in the first stanza. This is the third line in the second stanza. And that, but God will redeem me. He will surely take me to myself. So he draws a conclusion. Do not be overwhelmed. So he draws a conclusion. Human beings who have wealth but lack understanding are like the beasts that perish. Now, the difference in Hebrew here is one letter. The word where it says in verse 12, despite their wealth, do not endure. The Hebrew word there is yalin, Y-A-L-I-N. Loon is to endure. They will not endure, yalin. The difference in verse 20, but lack understanding, the Hebrew word for understanding is yavin, Y-A-B-I-N. And the whole thing is a riddle. It's a play on yalin. Nobody endures,
But there's a difference between a person with understanding and without understanding. And that's why the whole thing is a pun on Yalin versus Yavin. So it's worthwhile to do another psalm. That's a wisdom psalm. It's so typically wisdom that I think is a textbook example of a wisdom psalm. And that's just one of several. I think Psalm 1 is basically a wisdom psalm. So I find there are wisdom psalms. And I think they were taught in the temple. I think they, see, he says in the beginning, listen to my understanding and as I give it. But I think it's in the temple that he's given him. Then there are songs of trust, like Psalm 23. And people love 91 and 23. And rightly so, they're songs of trust and of comfort. But to represent the Psalter by those two misrepresents the character of this book, but the king in battle for the most part. And even there, he's protected from the enemy. And this has the entrance to Temple Psalm, Psalm 15, who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, who may dwell in his holy place? Well, it begins with a question, and it's who can come into the holy sanctuary, that place of God. And this has a very helpful exegetical expository value. And it helps you to understand words a bit. For example, the word ball, for example, ball on the sports page is one thing. Ball on the social page is a very different thing. The same word, but very, very different meanings. And words have very different meanings in different literature. And you have to be sensitive to the literature. So the word peti, for example, P-E-T-I in Hebrew, peti, which means to be open, in Proverbs is used for the simpleton because he's open to everything and committed to nothing. And it's a very pejorative term, to be open because you're not committed to wisdom. But in the Psalms, the peti is devout. He's open to God and not self-absorbed. So now it is a favorable term. And so this is very important to be sensitive to different kinds of literature. And this is what Baron said. When you're dealing with the apocalypse and when you're dealing with Daniel, you're dealing with a very different kind of literature than when you're dealing with Paul and the epistles. And you have to be very sensitive to the different kinds of literature for your interpretation. My final evaluation that to my what I observe here is that all of this usually brings praise to the scholar and not to the Lord. All this kind of erudition. I want to bring praise to the Lord. All right, now I want to look at one kind, which is dominant kind. 50 of the psalms are petition psalms, so a third of the psalter is petition. And as I've said, I'm largely neglected within the church today. Now, we said that psalms have distinct motifs, these different kinds of psalms. And here you have the five motifs, the normal motifs, of a petition psalm. I said they always have an address to God. And to go anywhere else than to God when you're in trouble for your security is to despise the way of faith. I'm not saying we don't use means. We do use means. But we depend upon God. And I illustrate it to help people understand trusting God and means. And I don't agree. I don't mean to pit them apart. I illustrate it from when my youngest child was daughter, who was about 4 or 5. We used to play David and Goliath in class at home, our Bible time. We would play out the Bible stories. And one of our favorite games was David and Goliath. And I'd stand on one end of the living room and she'd be on the other end. And I would say, David, I'm Goliath. And this is my sword. I challenge you to a battle. And she would say, I trust in God. And then we had in the corner of the living room, we had some ping pong balls and we had a dish towel. So then we square off a second time, she with the dish towel now and the ping pong ball. And I would say, David, I'm Goliath, this is my sword. I challenge you to a battle. And she would say, she was supposed to say, "I trust in God," and then she would swing the dish towel around, let the ping pong ball go flying, and who knows where, but Goliath always fell down. And the best part of the story, she would run over and jump on me and cut off my head, and that was the high point of the story. Now, when we're first learning this story, it was interesting to me that when we would square off the second time, I say I challenged her to battle, she would forget to say, "I trust in God." And she would go immediately to the ping pong ball. And of course, I wouldn't fall down because I was trying to teach you, you live by faith. But one night, we got it down pretty well, but one night, she said to me when we squared off the second time, "I trust in God." But she didn't throw the ping pong ball. Now what do I do? I didn't fall down. She said, "Daddy," I said, "I trust in God." I said, "I know, but you didn't throw the ping pong ball." In other words, faith works. And it may take more faith to go under the surgeon's knife than to lie on your bed and say, "I trust in God," is one of my point is. I think it's false to make this dichotomy. It takes faith to risk throwing that ping pong ball. You see what I'm saying? So it goes together and so forth. Okay, so you begin with, "I trust in God," address to God. Now, it's very important that when you read Psalm 3, you would think all he does is trust in God. But when you read the historical background, when he fled from Absalom, you realize he had a whole spy network set up where you had Hushai as a mole who was telling him exactly what the strategy of Ahithophel was and so forth, if you know that story. And you really have to know Samuel, I'm saying, to understand these historical psalms. It's against that background. Well, the second thing is the lament or the complaint. And here again, I feel a little bit cold doing this, but again, it's an analysis. Normally, the lament has three submotifs. That is, first of all, God appears absent. And you see that in Psalm 22. This is very common complaint. And when you're facing death, sometimes you feel God is not there. They are very honest with their emotions. And they say exactly how they feel. And they feel God is not present. And yet they know he's a very present help in time of trouble, but they express it. Also, they recognize that the enemy is too strong. And when you're facing death, you know that enemy is too strong. And then thirdly, the psalmist is at the point of death often. He can't go on much further. And we'll see that. Those are the normal three. You'll see often, you'll have it in Psalm 3, how many are my foes, how many are raising up against me. Many are saying there's no hope for him in God. Then comes the confidence section. Before they're ready to petition, they change the mood from lament and protest and complaint. They change the mood into confidence. And not always in this sequence, but these motifs are there. And it's here you get great theology, because it's at this point they're switching to flying by instruments. And they're going back to God's attributes. And they're going back to church's history. And so they go back to the great track record of our God and his sublime character. And here they reflect upon God. And as they reflect upon God, the mood of despair changes to a mood of hope. And this is the confidence motif. And then they come to the petition. And the normal word for petition is the Hebrew word yasha, which means the name for Jesus, save. Now, the word yasha has two meanings to it, to deliver. The first one is it has a military sense of rescuing you out of the situation. The second idea, it has a juridical sense, judicial sense, that it is right. It would be wrong not to deliver the person in that situation. So deliver means to deliver me because that's the right thing to do. Whereas you can deliver a person that can be unrighteous and they should not be delivered. in the Old Testament especially. So those are the two ideas. Then, after the petition comes praise. Now, what happens here, you have two kinds of praises. They say, God, when you answer my prayer, I'm going to offer up sacrifices to you. I'll fulfill my vows to you. And those are open praise. They're waiting for the experience before they enter into praise. There are other psalms where they go directly into praise. And the question is, how do they go from petition and directly into praise? And these are closed praise. They're not, it's a done deal. And many say that there was an oracle by a priest, as the case of Hannah and Eli, and she prayed for the child, and he said, may God grant you your petitions. Because she's essentially saying, God, remember me in my situation. And he says, may the Lord grant you. And she went home trusting the priest's oracle. Well, it may be, but I don't see it in the Psalms. That's my problem. It's too important, it seems to me. My own understanding of it is, from my own experience and my observation of the church, I think it's simply that by faith they'd count on God. I think the change is due to faith, and they simply count on God at that point. It's a change of psychology due to a change of faith, and they can enter into praise. And I think it's authentic. And sometimes they're more tentative, and sometimes they're more certain. And I think that's true to church's experience in our own prayer life. So some appeal to Psalm 60, but I don't find it convincing. Take a look at Psalm 60, for example, a miktam of David, teaching psalm, and there it tells us for teaching. Now here, you have to know 2 Samuel 8 to understand the historical background. When he fought Aram-Naharaim, Aram along the river, and Aram-Zobah, which was around Damascus, and when Joab returned and struck down 12,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. And that's all we have in one verse in 2 Samuel, which is only concerned with his victory. But we learn here that while he was engaged in that battle against the Arameans, the Edomites devastated the land while the army was away. And that's a complaint in this psalm. So take a look at it. It's by David, a miktam of David. And in typical language, he looks at the Edomites have had a great victory over him. And this is not recorded in the historical books. We have to fill this in. It didn't. The history is highly selective in its writing. So, you've rejected us, God, and burst upon us. You've been angry. Now restore us. You've shaken the land and torn it open, mending its fractures, for it is quaking. He likens the destruction to an earthquake. You have shown your people desperate times. You have given us wine that makes us stagger. So instead of wine of joy, it's wine that makes them drunk with staggering. But for those who fear you, you have raised a banner to be unfurled against the bow. No, he hasn't lost confidence. Now the petition, save and help us with your right hand, that those who love you may be delivered. Now he appeals to an oracle that we don't know about. Somewhere God has spoken from the sanctuary. In triumph I will parson out Shechem and measure off the valley of Succoth. What do Shechem and Succoth have in common? Why does he mention Shechem and Succoth? Shechem is in west of the Jordan. Succoth is east of the Jordan. So God has given him both halves, you see. And again, he follows that. Gilead is mine and Manasseh is mine. Where is Gilead? Transjordan. And where's Manasseh? West of the Jordan. You see what he's doing? So he has the southern part, East Jordan, West Jordan, and then he goes up East Jordan, West Jordan. And then he goes beyond that. Ephraim is my helmet and Judah is my scepter. So there you have the northern tribes and the southern tribes. So it's the whole thing that God has given to the people. But now, Moab is my wash basin, because it's located right on the Dead Sea.
And Edom, I tossed my sandal, probably like Ruth, making it his possession. And in over Philistia, I shout in triumph. So there is an oracle where God has victory over his people. Though he raises the question now, he comes back to the reality. Who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? Is it not you, God, you who've now rejected us and no longer go out with our armies? Give us aid against the enemy, for human help is worthless. With God we will gain the victory, and he will trample down our enemies. So before Joab took Edom, you have this psalm, a prayer, depending upon God, to give them victory over Edom. Who will lead me? And up to that point, no one had ever defeated Edom, because Edom was very mountainous like Switzerland. Nobody has ever defeated Switzerland. The terrain is just too rugged, and that's the truth here. So David got a name when he defeated the Edomites. That's when he became famous. But Psalm 60 is not, you wouldn't know about that. You have to put the historical book and the psalm together. This is the value of the historical approach. It really opens up some material for you. But you notice here, my point is the oracle came. Not at the oracle came, and then he doesn't go into a vow of praise. He goes back to petition. And the oracle gives him confidence. It's not an oracle that leads him into praise. And that was the point. This is the psalm that used to show there was an oracle that gave them the confidence for the vow of praise. And I'm saying, no, it doesn't work here. It's not followed by the vow of praise.
These courses provide a glimpse into our academic programs. Knox students can take 1 week or semester-length courses in person at our South Florida campus or choose to complete a degree entirely online. By bringing together academic excellence, a vibrant community of learning, and flexible scheduling, Knox offers today's students timeless truth through modern convenience. For more information about earning credit toward a master's degree, please visit our website at knoxseminary.edu.